Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. In this episode, Cancer Network's Arianna Pelosi spoke with Dr. Gary Steinberg from Rush University about the FDA approval of the gemcitabine intravesical system for patients with BCG-unresponsive, non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. The conversation touched upon topics such as supporting data from the Phase 2 SunRISe-1 trial, considerations for mitigating adverse effects like urinary frequency, and the next steps for researching novel therapeutic strategies in the field.
Just to start off, how do you see the gemcitabine intravesical system fitting into the current treatment algorithm for BCG-unresponsive, non-muscle invasive bladder cancer?
There's a tremendous unmet need for patients with BCG-unresponsive high-grade disease, and that traditionally the standard of care has been radical cystectomy. Clearly, patients would like to avoid losing their bladder, especially if they don't have any evidence of muscle-invasive disease. And over the past few years, we've seen new treatments that have been FDA-approved in this space. So the first was pembrolizumab, which is a checkpoint inhibitor, which was approved by the FDA in around 2020. We've also seen adstiladrin, which is an oncolytic immunotherapy, which was FDA approved in the spring of 2023. And then in about spring of 2024, we saw the combination of intravesical, that's medication put inside the bladder, BCG plus Anktiva, which is an IL-15 agonist. So we've got three drugs, all with different mechanisms of action. One is a combination. And now here we have a fourth treatment that's been FDA approved, again, a different mechanism of action. And so the patients and the physicians that take care of them for their bladder cancer are truly benefiting tremendously. Having said that, it is an older chemotherapeutic drug that's put into the TAR-200 device. It is a better way to deliver intravesical chemotherapy. And so many urologists today, because of the BCG unresponsive disease and because of the BCG shortages and because of their unfamiliarity with some of the new products and kind of shying away from using intravenous pembrolizumab, which is associated with its 11 to 12% grade 3 or greater immune-related adverse events, have been using gemcitabine and docetaxel, intravesical chemotherapy, a combination, not with any FDA approval or with any prospective data. And certainly, I think that with the prospective data we have from TAR-200 in the SunRISe-1 trial, that certainly that will probably replace the gem-doci, because clearly the numbers we see from the recent trial are superior to what we see from intravesical gem-doci. You know, there are some logistic issues in giving intravesical gem-doci. Having said that, there are some issues and some new logistics to be putting in the TAR-200 device and taking it out every 3 weeks. There are some significant side effects and treatment discontinuations with the device. And most importantly, we still need to see additional longer-term data with the TAR-200. It's critically important that when we use these new treatments that we have a complete response, but really what's most important in my view is the durability, the duration of response. So if patients have an 80% complete response rate, but at 12 months, they've only got 20% are still responding, such as with pembrolizumab, we see a 40% complete response rate and about 18% durable response rate at 12 months. We clearly want to do better than that. And so we see with pembrolizumab, the durability is about 18% at 12 months. With adstiladrin, it's about 24-25%. And this is in the BCG unresponsive carcinoma in situ patients. With the combination of BCG and Anktiva, it's around 30-35%. The durability for the TAR-200 is about 50% of the initial complete response of around 82% or so. And so it drops down to about the 42% durability at 12 months. We clearly would like to do better than that. And we do have a number of other agents in clinical trials that are still being evaluated, such as cretostimogene made by CG Oncology, which has presented their 24-month durability of about 90% of the patients who are in CR at 12 months. And at 12 months, the durability is about 64% to 68%, with an overall complete response rate of around 75%. And then there's also detalimogene. We're waiting for the completion of the LEGEND trial. It's a novel mechanism to deliver a couple of cytokines, RIG-I and IL-12, which turns on the innate and adaptive immune system. And they're finishing up the LEGEND trial, and so we're waiting to see the data from that as well. But it's a great time for patients and for doctors in that we are making a lot of progress. But we still need to complete some of these trials. And more importantly, we really need to look at the adverse events that we get from the various treatments, because quality of life and being able to tolerate therapy is very important as well.
Perfect. Thank you. So the prescribing information does include warnings about the risk of metastatic bladder cancer with delayed cystectomy. So what do you recommend an approach for a patient, counseling them and ensuring that they understand the importance of surveillance and the potential for disease progression while on this therapy?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and really something that needs continued study. You know, when you look at the older data versus the newer data, the risk of progression is not as high as we once thought. And as we see in the TAR-200 data, they did have 8% of their patients did progress to muscle-invasive disease within 12 months. So we do need to be very careful and make sure that we follow patients with cystoscopies and urinary cytologies and CT or MR imaging as needed. But in general, I think that we do have room to try one, if not two, and even potentially three additional therapies once patients become BCG unresponsive. We saw in the trial that led to pembrolizumab's approval in BCG unresponsive carcinoma in situ, the KEYNOTE-57, that there were a fair number of patients that did not respond to pembrolizumab, that did not undergo cystectomy and were followed with multiple different other therapies, and that the progression rate is still very low. I was one of the co-authors of a retrospective review. We took data from 10 different medical centers looking at retrospective data on patients who were deemed BCG unresponsive and looked at their additional treatments that they got over time, and that we saw that patients were able to get a second treatment. And once we started getting into that third and fourth line of therapy after BCG, we then begin to see more and more progression to muscle invasion. But I certainly think that patients are going to want at least one attempt, if not two attempts, with different mechanisms of action once they become BCG unresponsive and still have non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. But there's no question that the FDA has appropriately been concerned about progression to muscle invasion and metastatic disease while patients are on therapy. I think that we can allay their concerns in that, from what we've seen in the trials to date, and it's about six or seven different trials with different agents, that the progression rate is relatively low. We saw in the Adstiladrin trial, the progression rate or cystectomy rate was relatively low. And certainly with the BOND-3 for cretostimogene, the cystectomy rate and the progression of muscle invasion is about 3 to 4%. So not zero, but the majority of those patients can be curable still once they progress to muscle invasion if there's a prompt identification. But it's clearly a very important concern.
So looking at adverse effects, the most common included urinary frequency and dysuria. So how do these compare to other intravesical therapies, and what practical measures do you recommend for mitigating them and helping to improve quality of life for patients?
Yeah, there's no question that with TAR-200, it's a foreign body that's put in the bladder and stays there. Interestingly, for every three-week instillation of TAR-200, it's only delivering drug for one of those 3 weeks. So, you know, why you keep in a foreign body when it's only delivering drug for 1 week out of three is something that needs to be investigated. But there's no question that the number of serious adverse events, about 24% with the TAR-200, and a discontinuation rate of about 7%. Sometimes some of the presentations was as high as 9%. is of concern. The other thing that we saw a higher incidence of with the TAR 200 versus other trials is the lower urinary tract symptoms, the urinary tract infections, the frequency and urgency. And you know, treating patients, elderly patients with multiple rounds of antibiotics does lead to antibiotic resistance. Treating patients in their 70s and 80s with multiple medications for overactive bladder does lead to other side effects such as dry mouth and constipation and blurry vision and so forth. And many elderly patients don't necessarily tolerate the overactive bladder medications very well. So it is a fine line. You know, one of the things that I've been told anecdotally is that there are some, especially female patients, that a TAR 200 prednisol would be voided out. And so there is some delays and some therapy and needing to have the device put back in. But really, having a cystoscopy every 3 weeks for 6 months, and then every 6 months for up to 18 months, is something to consider. I was at the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network think tank meeting a few years ago, and we had patients who discussed their treatment with bladder cancer. And what was really striking was a number of patients really mentioned about how much they hate having cystoscopy, and that why isn't there a better way to identify bladder cancer other than cystoscopy? So patients do get instrumented a fair amount, and it's not something that they are happy about or like. And that the side effect profile from having the TAR 200 device in the bladder can last not just a day or two, similar to when you put an intravesical therapy in the bladder and the patient's voided out a couple of hours later, but these side effects can last the entire time they have the device in their bladder. And so that is something to consider. Now, I don't like to give prophylactic antibiotics to patients with foreign bodies in their bladder. I don't like to necessarily treat patients with antibiotics when they have a foreign body in the bladder, because it doesn't resolve nearly as well. And again, I'm loath to use overactive bladder medication in bladder cancer, especially if they have other side effects. How you mitigate that is still something to be determined, I believe, but it's not easy, especially when you think about the patient population that as a baseline have overactive bladder symptoms because of aging. So it is something to still consider.
Perfect. Looking ahead, what are some of the next crucial research questions that need to be answered for this newly approved agent?
In the Sunrise trial, they randomized and they had three arms. And one of the arms was the TAR 200 pretzel plus etrolimab, which is a checkpoint inhibitor. And that cohort was closed early. We haven't really seen all of the data from that cohort, but the preliminary reports were that the results, the complete response rate, and the durability was inferior to the TAR 200 device alone. And so that's an interesting question why that may be the case. I mean, the concept of any intravesical chemotherapy is that you're causing a tumor lysis and immune cell death. And if you create immune cell death, ultimately you upregulate interferon gamma, which turns off the T cells. And so that in general, a checkpoint inhibitor helps reverse that. And so why that didn't occur with TAR 200 is unclear. There are people that believe that TAR 200 is not just a chemotherapeutic drug, but when it's given in a low dose continuously, that it also has some immunologic effects. They've seen that in some animal models for pancreatic cancer in a mouse model. Clearly haven't seen human data to support that. And so that at the end of the day, a TAR 200 may function as intravesical chemotherapy alone, albeit given in a better way in terms of the pharmacokinetics than putting it in somebody's bladder and having them void it out in an hour or two, and that there should be more topical absorption. But as we know, cancer is smart. Cancer figures out ways to become chemotherapy resistant and extrude chemotherapy from the cells. And we know that when we stop chemotherapy in general, that's when cancers can come back, which is the whole reason why the whole oncology community is enthralled with immunotherapy, because with immunotherapy, we believe that we can create a T cell memory. And we do know that when you look at checkpoint inhibitors of all classes and all comers, that we have anywhere from an 18 to about a 25% durable complete response in all different types of tumors. That 25% we see is in the melanoma population. And that we clearly need to do better And so we're looking at combinations. That's where enfortinib, vedotin, and pembrolizumab have come in terms of metastatic bladder cancer. We do need to think about additional combinations down the road. And so the fact that gemcitabine in the bladder in the TAR-200 plus a checkpoint inhibitor did not show any additional benefit is of interest and something that needs to be addressed. And then most importantly, one of the really key questions that we all need to ask with all of our treatments is not about the patients who respond, but who about the patients who don't respond, so that we can begin to understand mechanisms of resistance, so that we can begin to target those mechanisms of resistance and treat them better. One of the things about cretostimogene is that it's replication selective in patients with bladder cancer that are B pathway deficient, which is about 70 to 80% of all patients with high-grade non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. So it has a selective treatment response. It really should cause viral killing only in the bladder cancer cells and not in normal cells. And that also what we see in the CORE-1 data, that in the combination of the cretostimogene plus a checkpoint inhibitor such as pembrolizumab, there was some additional complete response and durability. Having said that, you know, we don't necessarily want to give everybody checkpoint inhibitors because of the systemic side effects of checkpoint inhibitors, but cretostimogene alone clearly has demonstrated a best-in-class durability, at least that we've seen in BOND-3 at 24 months.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancer-network.